In the 20th century, what did we expect our mothers to be? Apron wearing, docile, tactile, and never critical. But one day we found out that our mothers are people and they have dreams and expectations. Today I'm welcoming onto Radio Gorgeous a woman who is an award-winning producer and documentary maker. She had a mother who did not fit in to the ideas of what a mother should be. She dreamed of stardom, glamour, and love. And Sarah Aspinall, her daughter, was along for the ride. She's written a memoir of her mother called Diamonds at the Lost and Found, published by fourthestate.co.uk. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to Radio Hello. Gorgeous.
Hello. Lovely to be with you.
Well, you're very welcome. So can we just start off by describing Audrey, your mother's character, from a child's point of view?
I think from a child's point of view, she just lit up the room. You know, I think I did feel that she was somebody special. I'd noticed that heads turned as she walked by. You know, I'd ask other people what their mums did for a living, you know, and I'd say mine jumps out of a cake and shouts Happy New Year at New Year's Eve and is a beauty queen. And she had a little social column in the local paper. And she always seemed to be telling these stories and people would be sort of open mouthed and saying, oh, that's amazing. And, you know, I was very aware that I felt she was special. And I think I felt rather proud of her. And of course, as a teenager, I got angry. And there were times getting older when I noticed that I was like the back of the pantomime horse, you know, sort of always there, but, you know, I can remember starting to tell little stories myself when I was about 8 or 9, and people would laugh and thinking, oh, maybe I can be like her. Maybe I'm not just her little shadow. So I think as a child, yeah, it depends what age, doesn't it? I think a lot of people, when you're little, your parent can just fill the sky for you. And then you start seeing them as people, you know, as you said in your intro. And as a teenager, you see them rather harshly as people. And then you you grow up a bit and, you know, change again. And, you know, I probably couldn't have written this book at any other time. I needed that, having been a mum myself, having had teenagers myself, you know, and starting to understand all these mysteries as well, because my childhood just felt like a swirling mist of fragments of her past and things that she'd say she'd done and they didn't add up. And it wasn't till writing the book that I realized they actually did add up. They were all true and more extraordinary than she'd even told me.
Fantastic. So what was her upbringing?
Very rough. The slums of Liverpool. Her father was violent. He'd made her go around the pubs as a bookies runner, which was illegal, so the police would come after them. She'd go around the pubs taking bets. And was often on the run from the police. And he didn't hit her really, but he hit her mother very violently in front of her. In the end, they managed to get away to her Uncle Charlie's coal yard, which was a bit full. They had to share a room with quite a few cousins. But she was the little star, you know, she was her mum's princess. She had an auntie, a godmother, who was a waitress who earned good tips, Auntie Sadie, who would pay for the dance classes and you know, Mum and Aunt Sadie had this little girl that they just wanted to be a star, and they got her on the stage as one of the fairies in the pantomime. You know, they got her. She was Queen of the May. Her Uncle Charlie's coal wagon used to pull the procession horse and cart on Protestants' Orange Day. She'd be Queen Bess sitting up on the horse. So she knew she was a little star. They'd lift her onto the table and say, you know, give us a song, give us a dance. She could tap dance. She was always a fantastic dancer, knew the words to 1,000 songs, and she'd sing all the time. If there was a moon, you'd get 10 songs about the moon. So from childhood, and when she was sent as an evacuee to Southport, she'd had days out there, and then it was a very gracious seaside. It was the Riviera of the Northwest. It was rather glamorous. So when she got evacuated there in her teens, I think she saw an escape route and she got a job as a hostess at the club. There was a big American airman club. All the girls couldn't believe their luck. Suddenly, Southport was full of hundreds of handsome Americans, you know, recovering from, you know, their plane crashing over France or something, the sort of heroic guys. And the Palace Club had, you know, had a jukebox, it had donuts, it had jitterbugging on Friday and Saturday nights with a live band. So it was sort of heaven. And she was collecting, you know, all these addresses of these men saying, you have to come and see me, honey, you know. So she was in love with this idea of America, you know, New York and the Midwest and, of course, Hollywood. And then Clark Gable turned up. He was shooting a film. He'd just made Gone with the Wind. So he's like one of the biggest movie stars in the world at that time during the war. And he was being heroic because he was actually flying in the war. And she pushed herself forward through the crowd and said, you know, I'll show you around town, and got to go with him on his day out around Southport filming. And of course, when he waved goodbye, he said, come and see me in Hollywood. So that made her determined to get there, which, you know, she did, which actually for a girl of 20 with no money, no connections, no career, left school at 14, it was a very hard thing to do, but Sadie married a GI and went out to New York and sent her a one-way ticket. But just before she left, she fell madly in love with this boy, James, handsome, blonde, floppy hair, tall, slim, you know, terribly sweet guy, and just fell madly in love. And it was getting in the way of all her dreams because she wanted to go to America. So they got engaged and she said, look, I'll go for a few weeks and I'll see, we'll get married when I'm back. They set a date. Anyway, so what happened? That was one of the mysteries. One of the mysteries was why she had me with my father, who was terminally ill. She wasn't in love with him. He died when I was six. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand why we'd moved from a scruffy little flat to the biggest house in Southport with a housekeeper and a driver. And then I didn't understand why we were traveling the world and going to Cairo, Hong Kong, Singapore. What were we doing? As soon as my father died, she just threw the suitcases on the bed and went, right, let's get this show on the road. She used to walk around the house, this big house, shouting into the rooms, bored, bored, bored. You know, she wanted this sort of glittering, exciting life. So she just took me with her and she got jobs on cruise ships and in motels and hotels. She showed people to tables and bars. Sometimes we had no money and she'd be crying on the bed and we'd be in some squalid room. I remember in Cairo, a horrible room with sort of water on the floor and my mum sobbing. The next minute we were in a sort of luxury hotel. I never knew why. she'd send me up to men in bars and I'd have to go up to them and go, I wonder if you could look after my mummy because I'm going to bed now. And then she'd come over and go, oh, what's my little girl saying? And pretend she was sort of, you know, flustered and embarrassed. But often the guy would look at her and go, well, maybe I could buy you a drink. She'd say, well, why not? So we were a very good double act. And
you were her hustler then, weren't you?
Really? I was her hustler. Yeah, absolutely. And I realized we were on a quest for love, the love that she'd lost with her long lost love, James, whose photograph was next to her bed when she died. And she told me he was the one. There was, you know, there were Hollywood stars. There were, you know, there were all sorts of guys in between. There was, she was engaged to Perry Guinness of the Guinness family. And, you know, he was in a big house in Park Lane when she got back from America. And I realized she'd got pregnant with me by accident because she'd felt sorry for my father. And she'd gone back to Southport and slept with him because he was madly in love with her. He'd actually got a bus to Park Lane to this fancy New Year's Eve party where she was with her fiancé, you know, the Guinness family. And he was in his duffel coat and he stood and sent her a little note saying, could I have one kiss at midnight? So she came out of the party and kissed him on the step and went back in. So the next time she saw him, she slept with him and then she got pregnant, but she didn't want to marry a poor boy who was dying. She sat outside the abortion clinic, but in those days that was quite a scary option.
Well, it was illegal, wasn't it?
It was illegal. She was too frightened to go in. So she had me, and to her credit, she was kind to my father, I think.
Why did she marry him? Out of respect to
him? She married him just because she was pregnant.
Yeah.
And she couldn't see another option. And she had to break off her engagement to the Guinness guy. And she was...
That was a massive blow because all her dreams had come true. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she'd lost, you know, the love of her youth. She'd lost the big glittering life that she was going to have, you know, and suddenly she was in this little flat. And in those days, you know, women, you didn't get invited to dinner parties. You didn't, you know, she used to say, no one invites me because they think I'll steal their husbands, which was probably, you know, true. She probably would have given it a shot. So it was, you know, yeah. And we did meet, you know, we met a lot of men on the road. I mean, there was the guy in Penang, he had a big house, he was a nice guy, but, you know, actually she did want to fall in love. She wanted it all. She wanted the big, amazing life, but she also wanted the big love affair. And she found it in the end, so.
And that was extraordinarily how she found him. I mean, it was the most fantastically theatrical beginning, I'd say, to a relationship. Can you tell us?
No, I'm not going to say anymore because I want people to get
It's my favourite. It is my favourite story, isn't it? Because it's so outrageous, isn't it? It's really, yeah. Really. Okay, well, actually, yeah. So you were very different from your mother because you obviously... you didn't know your father well, but you're obviously more like him. You were kind of bookish and quiet, and that was hard for you, wasn't it?
Yes, she would say things like, you know, she'd send me to dancing lessons and then she'd say, oh, you've got your father's two left feet. And she was always cross with me if my boyfriends or husband or couldn't dance. She'd go, not another one who can't dance. She like loved a Spanish.
Yeah, there like a
Spanish lover I had. She came over to Barcelona. I was living there for a year and managed to find this old dance hall, fabulous place that's at Barcelona, La Paloma, and danced all night with my man. You know, I was very cross. She used to get fed up with me. And I rather perversely, you know, didn't want to, I wanted to be a bit scruffy. I kind of, you know, I like the hippie era.
Yes. And you were in the hippie era. Can you tell us about it? Because listeners, there might be listeners that are a lot younger than us. So can you tell us about the smoking dope and free love aspect?
Yes, well, I was very much into that. But I started very young because I really rebelled when I was 13 or 14. And Southport had a big hippie influx. So even then I had a sort of old, I think he was a junkie called Chris from Manchester, who I used to steal fillet steaks out of my mum's deep freezer and go and cook them on his gas ring in his revolting little bedsit. I chased hippies, but I was a bit too young, so I ended up with sort of grammar school boys instead, which wasn't as exciting. But when I got to Oxford to do my A-levels when I was 15, I had sort of two tribes. I had the hippies down in Jericho who all, you know, Jericho was fabulous. I mean, it was all, you know, every Indian bedspreads in all the windows and, you know, squats. It was a squat village. It had bunting all across. It looked like sort of those San Francisco in the sort of 60s and 70s sort of, you know, scenes. And the pub we all went to was just dark. You opened a door and it was just thick with dope smoke, Dylan on the jukebox, you know, you were peering around at all this band of thieves and dealers and, you know, people having sex in the backyard. I mean, it was pretty wild. I loved it. There was a great big church tower that leaned over it, a bit like Italian St. Barnabas Church. I went recently, actually, and it's all still there. So that was the sort of landscape of my youth. And then, of course, up the road were all the colleges where there was a massive shortage of girls because, we were just so sought after. And the St. Clair's girls, the sixth form college I went to, which was half A-level college and half for foreign students, many of whom were wealthy, sort of European royalty. Osama bin Laden was there, really. And apparently he was quite a sort of hipster in his sort of loon pants and things. All the college guys in the sort of, you know, the beautiful Oxford colleges, which was a sort of, you know, absolute wonderland to me. I'd never seen anything like that. And, you know, punting on the river under the weeping willows and picnics and these boys who had sort of vintage sports cars. It was very Brideshead. There were a lot of people reliving Brideshead. You know, I remember getting my first sort of you know, college experience, and Chris, who's still a friend, with his sort of black nails and his black pearl earring, and one of those sort of beautiful oak panelled rooms overlooking a sort of quad of immaculate gardens and cricket pavilions, and you know, there was a sort of play they did, "Oh, What a Lovely War," out in the gardens by candlelight, and you know, I mean, it was a sort of magical place. And my school, we all called it the brothel. Paula Yates was there, who you might remember. She dubbed it the brothel because we'd climb out. We'd have to go in and see this nice little lady called Dot, who was our warden, who couldn't keep control. I mean, there were yogurt pots full of dope plants growing everywhere. And she'd go, "Aren't your plants doing well?" No idea what they were. But we'd climb out of this bathroom window, roll down a roof, quite dangerous, at sort of 11 o'clock, having signed in this book to say we'd come in and we're going to bed like good girls. And then you couldn't get back in. So you had to find a bed for the night, basically. And you know, I mean, you could either party all night and go down to the market where there was a greasy spoon called George's, where you'd sit and eat egg and chips, or, you know, or at dawn, that was open, it was full of lorry drivers. I remember we used to sit there in our fur coats with nothing underneath and sort of, you know, stick our legs out and, you know, get these lorry drivers. It was a very flirty time.
Brilliant.
But yeah, it was enormous fun, really. And, you know, I loved it, you know. I got a gorgeous boyfriend, and then lived for a year with him and six guys. So it was very Snow White, you know. I was like, had all my chaps, loved to cook. And yeah, I mean, you know, it was fabulous. But I mean, actually, I realised that the memoir I wrote, my story, just needs wrapping up at the end. You know, it's not about me. It's very much Audrey's story. And actually, of course, she would come down to Oxford and woo all my friends and make them laugh. And they all thought she was fabulous. And she loved Paula Yates. I think Paula Yates was much more the sort of daughter she'd have liked. When Paula got married to Bob Geldof and had sort of David Bowie as her best man, and she wore this scarlet ball gown for her wedding. And my mum used to look at that picture and go, "I knew Paula would make something of her life," and sort of look at me. I think my career as a documentary maker was much less interesting to her than the scarlet, you know, ball gown that Paula wore.
Well, it's the glamour. She was in love with the glamour. Now, I've got two more questions before we wrap up. The first is, can you tell the listeners about the title of the book, Diamonds That Were Lost and Found, what that means, please?
Well, it was a story she told me about a girl who had left her purse and had gone up to a girl from Liverpool with no money in a department store. And this man had been up at the lost and found, the lost property desk, and had given her a gift. My mum also had, when she was in New York, she'd won a contest called Queen for a Day, which she won a makeover. She got a night out with this rather handsome French actor called Louis Jourdan, who'd just been in a Hitchcock movie and was in Gigi and things. Mm. But she also got this lovely black cocktail dress, which I still have in the wardrobe, and a diamond pendant. And when she was, after this fabulous night out, which is all in the book, the publicist said, "Do you want me to put that in a safe?" And she realised it was valuable. So she sold it and got a one-way ticket on the train to Hollywood, because she had no money in her pocket. So, but I think really it was sort of the gifts that I got along the way. You know, the diamonds really were, when, you know, you don't know in life where your luck is. And often you look back and think things that happened at the time that may even have been tough or difficult, or, you know, have turned out to be the most precious things, the things that have taught you the most. Or so I think my life with my mum was a series of gifts. I think actually she showed me how to kick doors open, a lot of that sort of chutzpah. In the end, she'd always say, you know, you know, she used to sing this song, High Hopes, about a little ant trying to move a rubber tree. And of course, in the end, he moves the rubber tree. She'd sort of say, if you want it, go out and get it, you know. Yeah, and I think, you know, I was no great beauty, but I was always incredibly good. People would go, "How did you get him?" pointing at some gorgeous guy I'd got. So I think also her sort of ability to sort of charm and flirt. I remember her giving me flirting lessons, which are all in the book, and which I deployed against, you know, much more gorgeous friends, and would sort of, you know, when we were very young, and, you know, So I think she taught me a lot, and she showed me how magical the world can be. You know, she was someone who was very alive. You'd turn a corner and she'd see something and she'd go, oh, look at that. And I think I still have that feeling, you know. And in lockdown, I think a lot of us have had that about, you know, a rose bush or a tree, you know, that just finding the wonder in life. But it's something that I think definitely you can share with people, you can pass on to people, and you can give to your children, you know.
Her enthusiasm and zest and joy, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so lastly, if Audrey, you think, was born later in time, and she could have had a career, because this is a thing I've been thinking constantly about, what do you think she would have done?
She'd have probably wanted to be you. She'd like to have a show. She'd like to be interviewing people. She was very good at drawing out people's stories. Mm-hmm. She liked that. She'd have probably loved to be Paula Yates, crashing into rock stars' dressing rooms and photographing them in their underpants. And she'd have liked that. She'd have probably loved being Graham Norton. She'd have liked doing the Eurovision show. I think she'd have probably done... She'd have done what I did, you know, making documentaries very well. She was a very good storyteller. She probably could have been a good writer. She had definitely a sense of narrative. She'd always find the punchline, you know. She'd find the joke. She had a sort of natural Irish gift of the blarney and the storytelling. So probably something like that. I mean, she certainly probably wouldn't have had to be, you know, looking for a man to bring her a life. You know, I mean, like her, she taught me you need to have a man at your side. You know, it's quite an old-fashioned story in a way of a man pleaser, you know, which nowadays young women don't feel they need or want necessarily. But I suppose I didn't feel that man had to bring me the life I wanted. At free, you know, I was free to just, you know, make my own life. And she sometimes would seem helpless. You know, there were moments, you know, I remember seeing Streetcar Named Desire and Blanche DuBois and that being so bewildered and lost and needing a man and sort of seeing echoes of my mum and thinking she is at times very vulnerable because she
doesn't... How old were you when you realised that?
Oh, young. I realised that as a child.
Mm. So that made you grow up overnight, didn't it?
Yeah. I thought, I don't want to be helpless. I don't want to be always looking for, you know, Blanche's phrase was, you know, I rely on the kindness of strangers. You know, it was a great movie of it with Marlon Brando. And my mum relied on the kindness of strangers. You know, even when she was older, she was always looking for an arm to lean on, and she'd look up at some man and say, thank you, know. And that's, you know, I wanted to be able to stand on my own 2 feet and bring up daughters who could stand on that, which they said can stand on their 2 feet. You know? So I think it was a trickier time for women, you know.
It was, because even my mother, she still looks up to men, you know, and men seem to meet her. She was born in 1941. Men seem to her to be more important, you know, and to be respected and listened to, and, you know, and they, you know, men, you know.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's... But then I think, you know, she was good at making men happy. And, you know, I told a friend once how, you know, when my stepfather came in, she would jump up from the chair when he came home from work and go, you know, hello, you know. And I'd do that, you know, when Robbie walks in, I go, Robbie, you know. And, you know, my girl sort of wince a bit, but then, you know, it's actually a generous thing to do, to be good to the person you live with and to be kind and make them feel good about themselves. So I think the sort of feminist, you know, disapproval of being too nice and wanting to keep your man on his toes and knowing his place. But of course, we all watch pendulums swing back and forth, don't we? And it's classic that, you know, at my time in life, I would feel a pendulum had swung in many ways too far the other way, and I look forward to it coming back again. I feel very sorry for men at the moment. I think they're thinking, you know, how do we get it right? What do we do? How do we pick up a woman that we like? You know, how do we, you know, it's a difficult time for them. And, you know, a lot of women are sort of relishing that and saying, well, about time, you know. As someone who likes men, I feel a bit sorry for them.
It will go the other way, because you're a documentary maker, you understand history, everything swings, you know.
Yeah, everything. And in the end, kindness is what counts. It's whether
and love. Love is giving, isn't it?
Yeah,
love is giving and love is giving and kindness. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. And your mother did that to you. So thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
I really enjoyed talking to you.
You are a delight. And I mean, you know, I could just spend all day listening to stories about your fantastic mother, Audrey. So the book's called Diamonds at the Lost and Found and published by fourthestate.co.uk and written beautifully by Sarah Aspinall, her lovely, lovely, lovely daughter. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. It's been a delight to meet you.
Thank you. It's been gorgeous.
Oh, pleasure.